So I was wondering, Chris, if you could just introduce yourself and share a bit about your current role and background in the industry.
Chris DeWitt, I'm a partner at KPMG. I've been here for just over 2.5 years. Actually, I've only been in Australia for 4.5 years, so originally a Kiwi. But I spent the first 18 years of my life in another consulting firm called EY's. I assume you all know who EY is. Worked overseas with them in Singapore and in Europe. I was there from when I left uni all the way through as a partner. I was there for their 6 years as a partner. And I worked mainly in the financial services sector. So that's with banks and insurance companies at a time in corporate life where those two industries changed quite significantly. Significantly from the perspective of they're both regulated here and overseas, and a lot of harmonization of the regulation of those industries. And every time there's a corporate failure, there's a lot of learnings around the effectiveness of that regulation. So if you sort of think back to 2008, the failure of the banks was a big event globally, and actually understanding the interconnectedness of the banking system globally and how the regulatory model is designed to protect or not protect in that situation. And yeah, so lots of learnings coming along. And I guess with the Royal Commission here in Australia in 2018, that's also had quite a significant impact on those industries as well, in terms of A, how they engage with customers, B, how they protect shareholder funds, and C, how they manage the risk of things like cyber risk, if we look more recently to things like Medibank as well. So yeah, it's interesting. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's definitely quite an important amount of like time to do consulting over that industry with all those changes. What
I didn't actually say in there was a 7 year spell where I went in where I went into industry, and I spent 7 years with ASB and Westpac and AIA, three different companies, but in different corporate roles. And then I had a bit of a break from consulting, and that was really interesting too, because I got to learn a lot about what it's like to be on the other side. Most of those roles were program and transformation type roles, so not so much sort of BAU roles. Sorry, you go ahead, Caitlin.
No. That was super informative. I was going to ask you what motivated you to choose consulting in the first place, but now that you've mentioned that, what also motivated you to go into industry as well?
I didn't really choose it, to be honest with you. I mean, I tell people this all the time, because I've been working now for close to 30 years as well, and the industry that I work in has changed enormously during that time. When I joined Ernst & Young, it was an audit and tax firm, and I actually joined as an auditor. And when you look at the mix of business back then versus now, these firms are more consulting firms now. The audit practices are very small, and what I remembered it to be versus what I see them doing now is obviously quite different. But look, I didn't really choose. I'm the first one in my family to get a university education. So when I left, I just followed the career advice of people around me. I chose accounting and economics because for me it was more likely to get a job as well, and I didn't know much about uni, so I just did that, and I was reasonably good at it at school. And then I ended up going to EY as a graduate, so and ch changed my life a little bit, because I'd never been on a plane before I started working with them, and immediately I'm flying everywhere. So yeah, it's quite a big change. But over time, of course, when I went into the other thing that's probably interesting about that time period as well, when I went into EY, I think someone with my background, not coming from a family of academics, was probably diversity back in the day, to be honest. And now diversity means obviously something very, very different. So it's been interesting to be on that journey and see how all of that's changed as well. So yeah.
I was wondering if you could just tell us what areas do you think are positioned to have large growth in the next 5 to 10 years, so like the short to medium term?
It's a really hard question to answer, George, to be honest with you. I mean, the only thing that's really going to be informative is the things that you've seen develop, in the last sort of 5 to 10 years, and imagine that trajectory onwards. But the other thing that's about the last sort of 5 to 10 years of working as well is that what you thought was going to be significant in terms of technology change either was very quickly or wasn't that significant at all, or something completely different came along that changed. And I think, you know, interestingly, in terms of how organizations are structured and managed, you know, the COVID lockdowns had a significant impact because all of a sudden a lot of technology was invested in areas of the business that were never invested in before to try to automate, you know, the services, the corporate, like HR, technology, and make them less people-centric and more enabled through technology. So that's automated a lot of those activities, and that's allowed all people who work in those parts of organisations to work from home a lot more, which has changed the dynamic of working considerably. We're all through these type of channels now. I think it has the potential to create a lot more globalisation in the business world. But you know, the other thing as well is globalisation, you know, is no longer the hot topic for business. Obviously, things like AI have enormous potential to disrupt. And I think all things data related. You know, I mean, I had the opportunity when I was at ASB to go up to China, and that was 2016, and see how the platforms Tencent and Alibaba were evolving within business in that environment. And what was not well understood is that, you know, things like MasterCard and Visa, they don't really exist in that part of the world, and most of the everyday banking is done through what's the equivalent of Facebook or Apple for us, if you think about what, you know, Tencent and Alibaba is in that part of the world. So the opportunity for those platforms to still evolve and become more integrated into the way we live through our phone and through devices is there. If you had have asked me in 2016, I would have said to you by now we would already be there. So it's a bit hard to look forward and say, but certainly AI has enormous opportunity to change industry. In the sectors that I work in, it has enormous opportunity to change banking. I think what I was going to say when you asked that question is probably the thing that's changed the most for me in the last 10 years is the pace of change has increased significantly. And when I think back to 15, 20 years ago, when large technology investments were being made by companies, you know, they were looking for payback times of, you know, 10, 12 years. That's unrealistic now. When you invest in technology, really it's going to have a valuable life of a maximum of 5 years. You can't look beyond that. So, you know, I think the pace of change is going to be significant. There's going to be a lot of businesses that are going to get disrupted. You know, we think about brands like Kodak and stuff like that. That's more likely to happen now than at any time before, partly because of that pace of change. Now, what that exactly is, I couldn't tell you, but yeah.
And also I was wondering, so we've had this massive AI kind of boom in the past couple of years, and there's been plenty of articles going on about how there's a potential for AI to replace consultants. Do you think this is something that can be realized, or it's just a fad?
Look, I don't know that we have had the AI boom just yet. I mean, I'll be honest. I think it's still very much in a test and learn phase. If I look at a lot of clients that we work with, they're using it in discrete ways. Mm. And, you know, there's some really fantastic examples out there. And I'll give you an example of one bank we're working with who has implemented a product that essentially uses AI to scrape regulatory requirements from regulators all over the world. So they work with a lot of different jurisdictions, and they then take all of that into a master inventory, and they compare that back to actually what is the controls that they have documented within their own operating environment to see whether there's any non-compliance. Now, that removes a massive project from an organization like us, to be honest with you. So that's an example of where consulting has been displaced by technology capability. Mm. But, you know, I think we've already had large periods of technology disruption in consulting. Like, you know, if I think about this firm being an audit firm largely, you know, 20, 25 years ago, well, not necessarily AI, but tools like Xero and MYOB and the harmonization of accounting standards means that the work that an auditor does is so different from what I did, you know, 25 years ago. So I think that impact is going to be there. I think the value pools are going to shrink and expand. But one of the things that's really interesting about consulting is that the capability of consultants tends to move into wherever the value is being created. So it would be, I can't see it being in a situation where we are going to necessarily shrink or be replaced by machines. I think the nature of the work we do is going to change rapidly because of the capability of machines. and maybe some consulting skills will die very quickly, and others will emerge, you know. So it's probably a better explanation on that front.
I guess that's like the evolution of consulting is always going through something like that in a way.
There's a bigger risk, I think, to static roles that haven't changed for a long time, like claims processing and insurance, for example, product onboarding in a financial services entity. A lot of that stuff is more capable now of being automated very quickly, and eliminating those lower value processing teams that have existed for large periods of time. You know, so that sort of thing is very, very possible, I think, in the next little while.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned before that when you went into uni, you kind of just went with what you thought was the right idea and what people were telling you. Now that you've done that and you've had this really long, successful career, what would you have done differently at that time?
What would I have done differently? Probably not so much in terms of the study. I mean, if you ask me what I studied and was it the right thing? Yes, no. I think a lot of it really comes down, I mean, I say this to people all the time. After you've been working for 5 or 6 years, it becomes more about the experience of that 5 or 6 years rather than the academic background you had coming into it. Obviously, that's not true if you're studying a topic like law or somewhere where the study sets you up to get an accreditation to work in a very specialised field, but I haven't done that. And I think when people look at things like technology is really interesting. I mean, you asked questions before about AI, you know, the people that are going to know more about machine learning and some of the tools that are existing now are probably people coming out of universities with master's degrees, you know, like they're going to have more relevant skills than someone who's been working as a data scientist for 20 years in a bank or an insurance company, because the tools that they will be very, very experienced in using will be tools from 20 years ago. Now, they can probably adapt to new tools if they're self-learning and self-developing, but that's a behavior, you know, as opposed to an academic background. It's a behavior of, you know, basically embracing change and embracing development and looking for new ways of working and trying to find new, you know, strategic ways of working all the time. So I think probably my answer to you is this, you know, I look back and I think one of the things that I was curious, I always put my hand up to do something different. When they said to me after 2 years in EY, do you want to go and work in Singapore? I didn't know anything about Singapore. I said, yeah, cool, let's go and do that. And I learned so much from doing that. And then I got a role from there to go to Holland. So I went to Holland. And, you know, when they said, do you want to leave auditing? That was the biggest part of the firm. Do you want to do risk consulting? Yeah, what is that? That sounds pretty cool. And then it kind of all followed like that, you know. So I feel like the natural instincts you have as a young person to be curious is very, very important. And having the courage to follow that, or perhaps maybe courage is the wrong word, lack of fear of not following something that feels like it's, you know, very, very structured, is probably the way to go, because especially in an environment where business is going to change more and more and more. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Very long answers.
No, I like it. I feel like I've learned a lot from that. You need to just go for it, essentially.
What other questions do you have?
I wanted to ask about your 2 years at Westpac. So that was following their AUSTRAC fine, which was, from my understanding, the largest AUSTRAC fine in history, wasn't it? It was 1.2, 1.3 billion?
Or 1.3 billion Australian, yeah. It was,
yeah.
Australia was the largest fine, yeah.
So what was your role in that? How significant or important was it in creating a new sort of framework to prevent, you know, the quite a large series of mishaps that resulted in that fine?
Yeah, look, I've got to be careful, obviously, what I talk about there. But, I mean, my role there was the global, the official title was the Global Financial Crime Transformation, Head of Transformation. So I ran the program, essentially, that responded to the AUSTRAC matters. And it's all public. So I work very closely with a number of people in the business. Obviously, there's business owners that own the business processes that, you know, were found to be faulty or had issues around compliance. There were also then other individuals within the business that had the responsibility for defining what good compliance for a financial crime looked like. And my role really was to bring together the team of people that took those requirements from the policy teams and then worked with the business to change the business processes to lift the processes to where they needed to be. So whether that's processes, whether that's data, and look, financial crime is a really complex area for a bank because it is it relies on customer and payment data that sits in product systems that in some cases are 25 years old and or older, and those systems were never designed to collect and maintain the level of precision in the data that the financial crime rules and requirements require to be able to do the reporting. So, you know, in the press, I think the press talked about 29,000 lost payments. Well, they weren't really lost payments because customers still transacted and completed the exercise of moving money from their accounts to whoever they were paying. But it was more a case of, you know, being able to track and trace those payments at the level of granularity that they needed to meet their reporting to the regulator. So there was a range of issues there, George. Some of them, I think, you know, obviously the bank self-disclosed a lot of these things to the regulator, but my role in there was to essentially stand up the project team to run that process, and we did that by doing a series of deep dives in different areas of financial crime to identify issues. We then tracked those issues into deliverables in the program that were intended to address those issues, and obviously worked with a range of stakeholders across the bank to complete that. And a lot of those issues were then checked and validated by external firms, one of which was KPMG, and those external firms then provided independent assurance over what was done, and that was how we sort of got to the point eventually where the regulator was comfortable that all the things that they had highlighted had been addressed. So that was the role I played in there. But it was a very interesting time. It was a very interesting experience as well. You know, change is never easy in an environment where there's so much public and external scrutiny and where there's a lot of change in senior stakeholders inside the organisation as well. It makes the dynamic of trying to, A, identify what needs to be changed, and B, getting agreement around how to change it sustainably. It makes that quite a challenging exercise. But, yeah, it was a great learning opportunity for me as well.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That would have been super interesting. So obviously this podcast, we're hoping that uni students are listening to it. And I'm sure a lot of people listening would be very curious and eager to know what a partner like yourself is looking for in new recruits at places like KPMG.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It's a really interesting question. I think you probably could ask 10 different partners and get 10 different answers. So, you know, I can only really talk from my own experience. I do think that consulting is a great place for young people to start their careers, and partly because, you know, what I observed when I went into these big banks is that they have great graduate programs as well. I think they're great graduate programs, but what tends to happen as a graduate coming into a big organization is that you end up getting buried in a large program of work for a long period of time, and you know, you can be doing different things in that part of the business, but you don't get the variety of experiences that you get when you come into consulting. And consulting also does force a set of behaviours that mean that you learn quickly. Obviously, people are paying for your time, and you need to deliver solutions within an agreed schedule and agreed timeframes. And you're also working in blended teams. So when you come into an environment like this, you're not sort of left to churn away in the corner and run reports and do analysis on your own. You're effectively sitting around a table like this, or sitting on a Zoom or a Teams like this, with people with different skill sets, different levels of experience and different insights to solve problems together. And what ends up happening is things get divided up, and you'll get left to do your part, yes, but you know, your part has a lot of dependencies on everyone else's parts, and there's a lot of checking in within the team to make sure that everything's on track as you would expect. So when you're looking at people coming in, you're looking for a variety of skills. You're not really just looking for someone who's academically bright, because what that's really calling out is that you turned up to uni, you know, you committed yourself to the schedule of learning what you set out to learn, and you did that fairly well. But it doesn't mean that you're very good at human interaction. It doesn't mean that you're very good at dealing with ambiguity. It doesn't mean that you're terribly good at time management too. I mean, I observed that with my own daughter. She can get great marks, and God knows when she's doing the studying. I've got no idea. But, you know, this is the thing, right? So Because the other thing that's important as well is that, yes, when you start off in your career, you have a lot of knowledge that you've taken with you from university, and you're going to build experience through work, but you have a lot of time as well. But as life goes on, other things start to squeeze that time. If you have children, you have sick parents, you have other pressures outside of work, that means that you need to be very, very skilled at organizing your time and prioritizing your time in the 8 hours that you're at work to work with your colleagues to get things done. So I feel like it is about the curiosity. You need to be curious, and you need to be someone who's going to continue to learn. All right. You need to have a good base and demonstrate a good academic skill set to get to that base. You also ideally would want to be somebody who has demonstrated an ability to work with different types of people to achieve good outcomes. That means that you can deal with people with different behavioral traits, different cultural backgrounds, different religious beliefs, or whatever it is and not get disrupted by that, but still be able to work with whatever's there to get to the outcome. It's somebody who can actually create and foster a good team dynamic as well. Like, one of the things that's great about having graduates is that when they come into the team, they're bright, they're enthusiastic, they bring different ways of thinking, they ask questions. Having the confidence to ask questions, that's very, very important. You're really, it's interesting, the people that come in at junior levels and flourish quickly are the ones that are just soaking up information and trying to very quickly move into an environment where they're contributing to the conversation, and not concerned too much about whether they're contributing well or not, but they're just contributing, and eventually they are contributing well. And yeah, so I don't know whether that gives you a good answer or not, but I'm sure you get different answers from different people.
That's a fantastic answer. And like, with those traits, how are they being demonstrated when these people are applying for roles? Is that something that you mainly see in the interview process, or does that come down to like even their resume, their weighted average mark, things like that?
Look, I think certainly the academic skills come through the transcript, right? I feel like it's a door opener for most organisations. Most organisations, when it comes to graduates, they run these sort of they run these workshops, yeah, and part of it's to stress and test the non-academic skills of the individuals coming in. How do they present? How do they work under pressure? How do they deal with conflict in the teams around and the people around them? Because as that environment starts to play out, inevitably some people will just get the project done on their own. Well, that's not quite what we're looking for, because this is a teaming environment. So, but also just watching the dynamics when you're in those workshops and you're in those kind of environments to say, well, look, how do people respond? Do they ask for help? Do they try to negotiate and find ways through so that everyone feels like they're winning and contributing? It's less actually about the outcome, and it's much, much more about how the team forms and functions together, really. And in some cases, and I don't sit in these workshops, Caitlin, but I've seen before, sometimes it's a bad thing if you're actually in a high functioning team, because actually nothing really gets tested. You know what I mean? And that's not the way it is when you come into this environment, not every team's a high functioning team.
I just had one question about so obviously at KPMG it's quite a pyramid structure. You have consultants, senior consultants, managers, and so on until you get to partners. And I think the partner to non-partner ratio is 1 to 20 or something like that. So it's fair to say that majority are not partners and won't get there. So what distinguishes someone to get to that partner level?
That's a really good question. I think one of the things about these environments is that it doesn't matter whether you do get to partner or not. I think people probably need to sort of understand that. I mean, these firms can contribute a lot to people at different points in their career. I do feel like when you think about somebody's career, regardless of whether they stay in a firm like this and become a partner or they leave, most people's career, if you sort of have a way of thinking about it in terms of an axis of experience and time, over time you're going to build experience. And look, that path is not always going to be a straight line. It's going to go on sort of big jumps where you get the opportunity to do complex pieces of work, and then sometimes you're going to plateau for a while because you're just not in a situation where you will do anything that's going to test you to learn new things. A lot of it's down to the individual, though, as I say before, like the individual's actually always reading and saying, for example, with AI, right? Like when we go out to a client, you know, how many people in the team are thinking about how AI could be used to run this business process we're looking at differently? You know, so not everybody thinks that way. What are the traits that in this environment that sort of lead to people being a partner? I think that's whatever answer I give you today, George, is going to be different for, say, 10, 15 years' time. Like, I think these firms have traditionally found partners from the graduate ranks. I don't know that that's going to be true in 10 years' time. It's already quite different today than what it was 5 years ago. You're going to have a lot of people like me that want to leave and learn different things and might come back or might not come back because it's not what they want to do. So I do feel like you need to be somebody who enjoys going into different businesses and enjoys, you know, building relationships with people. You also have to be someone who enjoys problem solving. You have to be somebody who is always developing the way in which you think about how you solve problems so that you're bringing in new ideas, new capabilities, new thoughts. AI is an example of a new capability, and always stopping and saying, well, how could we do this differently? You also need to be someone who's actually able to leverage and create good teams. So, you know, you talked about 20 to 1. So when we go out and do some work, I'm always working with people of different skill sets and different experience levels. And, you know, one, you need to be able to construct a team that has that sort of pyramid structure, but you also need to be able to construct the culture in that team in such a way that everybody feels like that they can contribute and are going to be able to take those personal risks that I talked about before to try and contribute as quickly as they can. So that's probably the key thing, I think. I don't know if that answers the question or not.
No,
it
absolutely, that was
does.
great. I think that was perfect. In like a different vein, we're going to ask, what's something that's outside of work for you that keeps you motivated to keep doing what you're doing?
I love fitness, so I have my whole life. One of the bad things about sort of working in a corporate environment is you're stuck in a seat behind a screen all the time. So I've always been somebody who enjoyed going to the gym or running, and so I do a lot of that. Probably the thing I look forward to each year is my older son and I. We done in the last couple of years done quite a few tramps together, or hikes rather. We call them in Australia, so I shouldn't call them tramps, but it's hiking. And I'm from the South Island of New Zealand, so we tend to go back to the South Island and we climb up into the mountains. And you know, it's such an amazing time because you're away from devices. There's no Wi-Fi or anything up there, and you're just together in the wilderness and walking from hut to hut and walking through some beautiful scenery. And you know, inevitably something happens on these trips, and you have these great experiences. But you know, it's things like that with friends as well. It's just about having a balanced life, really. I mean, whatever your thing is, you just need to make sure you have a balance. And you see a lot of people coming into this work environment and then all of a sudden become so committed to it, they don't have that balance in their life. It's very, very, very important, I think, to try to learn that quickly. And because, you know, you've only got so much time, right? You've got to make sure you use it well. So, sorry, I've got a
Absolutely.
whole lot of alarms going off on my end. So.
That's wonderful. I think that's good. I guess like throwing yourself into your career and doing absolutely nothing else isn't necessarily going to make the best like career out of it anyway.
Well, it doesn't make us the happiest person in the career. You can make maybe you create a good career, but not necessarily the happiest person. But
Yeah, but surely happy people work harder.
maybe I like to think so, yeah.
I hope so. I think that's all the questions that we have for you today. That's been super insightful. We really appreciate you coming on and telling us all of the insider info in consulting.
No, it's been a pleasure to meet you, Caitlin, and good to see you again, George. And I'm sorry I had to move that from last Friday, but happy to
No,
help. And yeah, hopefully this is what you were hoping for.
it was. Thank you so much again, Chris. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people will find this pretty insightful stuff.
No, problem at all. I'd like to see the whiteboard behind you there with my best ever idea.
Yeah. No, thanks.
Thanks, Anne. Bye-bye.
All right. Have a good
Thanks so
one. See ya.
much.